programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Communique.
Jean-Luc Brunel, a famous French model scout and fashion industry figure, has been found dead in his prison cell in what appears to be a suicide. Brunel was a close associate of infamous billionaire and sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, who is also supposed to have hung himself in his cell. We've heard about Epstein and the sex trafficking and the victims who've come forward, but why has the media said nothing about the blackmailing aspect that Epstein and his close associate Ghislaine Maxwell were using underage girls to gather dirt on politicians so they could blackmail them? And what about the relationship to Israel's intelligence service, the Mossad? Today, we're going to try and answer these questions and look at the saga a little more carefully. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On Saturday, February 19th, 2022, Jean-Luc Brunel, a prominent French model scout, was found dead in his cell in La Santé prison in what has been called a suicide. Now, you might be wondering, why should this be of any particular interest? Because Brunel was not just a big figure in the fashion industry, he was also a close associate of billionaire sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Brunel stands accused of sexual assault and having partaken in alleged sex trafficking ring run by Epstein. To be frank, he was providing young girls to Epstein for sex. And for lack of a better word, he was a pimp. Now, according to one of the victims, Virginia Gouffray, Epstein admitted to her that he had, quote, slept with over 1,000 of Brunel's girls. And it was from Virginia Gouffray's civil suit against Epstein's close associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, that we know of Brunel's name as well. And this is one day that we see these court documents unsealed, one day before Jeffrey Epstein's death. Now, Jeffrey Epstein was known for living a lavish life and always inviting very prominent figures like actors and high-level politicians and businessmen to fly around with him on his private jet. And so Jeffrey Epstein would go and invite these people to his private islands, right, where they would have intercourse with underage girls that he had trafficked through his associates, such as Maxwell or Brunel, who were running these fashion and model agencies where they would get these girls from. And so following the revelations of this scandal, you know, people are starting to wonder, are these prominent figures, the politicians, the actors, all of these people we see in the photographs with Epstein, did they also participate in this sex trafficking ring? Because many of their names appear on the flight logs of Jeffrey Epstein's private jets. One of those names is, of course, Jean-Luc Brunel. The flight logs list him as a passenger 25 times on Epstein's private plane. And so who exactly was Jeffrey Epstein, the real Jeffrey Epstein? And why are there so many secrets surrounding this whole case? Now, back in 2008, Epstein pleaded guilty for soliciting a minor for prostitution. He served 13 months in jail. But unlike most prisoners who have to stay in prison, Epstein was given the luxury of being able to work out of his office 6 days a week. Now, one of the women who has come forward to accuse Epstein of sexual assault is Maria Farmer. When Maria Farmer was just a young art student, Epstein bought one of her paintings. She was recruited to work as his art advisor. And Farmer claims that Epstein showed her an entire system of secret video surveillance that he had set up inside his property with cameras in the bedrooms and the toilets. Now, Farmer was the first victim to officially report Epstein's behavior and abuse to the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI. However, at the time, you know, the authorities just didn't seem to take her accusations seriously, and there was no investigation. When Ghislaine Maxwell found out that Farmer had paid a visit to the FBI, she began threatening her with physical violence.
What sort of threats has she made against you?
Originally, it started with things like, I'm going to burn your art, and then I'm going to burn your career, and then I'm going to burn you and the house you live in. And then it was, oh, be careful crossing a street. You know, you can get shot in the back of the head. You know, they were threats against my life. And I told the FBI this.
It wasn't just Maxwell, Brunel, and Epstein doing this. The victims have also accused many high-level officials, billionaires, professors, even the British royal family, Prince Andrew, of having partaken in this sex trafficking. Epstein provided them with young girls, which they abused. Now, earlier, I talked about the flight logs and how Brunel's name appears there. But you might be more familiar with former U.S. President Bill Clinton or Donald Trump, whose names appear multiple times on Jeffrey Epstein's flight logs. Now, Jeffrey Epstein was finally arrested on July 6, 2019, on federal charges for sex trafficking minors, and he pleaded not guilty. They then put Epstein in New York City's Metropolitan Correctional Center, also known as MCC, and they put him on suicide watch because he reportedly tried to take his own life. Now, when you're put under suicide watch, that means you're under 24/7 surveillance. But after an assessment by a high-level psychologist, Epstein was taken out of suicide watch, and they put him instead in a special housing unit, or an SHU. And so barely a month after his arrest, on August 10th at 6:30 a.m., Jeffrey Epstein is found dead in his cell by apparent suicide. And it turns out that the guards had fallen asleep and there's no camera footage. And with Brunel's suicide, the same thing. There's no camera footage. The cameras were not working. Now, look, there are many theories floating out there about Epstein's death, specifically because a lot of things don't add up. And even then, Attorney General William Barr, he himself admitted to some, quote, serious irregularities. There are also numerous suicide prevention experts who also expressed serious concern. Senior staff counsel with the National Prison Project of the American Civil Liberties Union, Eric Balaban, raised questions as to why Epstein's life was risked by putting him in this restrictive special housing unit, or SHU, specifically when he had shown suicidal tendencies. According to him, an SHU is just not an appropriate thing for someone who's shown recent suicidal tendencies. Now, I can recall as I was attending the extradition hearing of Julian Assange, one of the people testifying was none other than Maureen Baird. Maureen Baird is the former warden of that very prison, MCC, where Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. And she spoke about the prison conditions there, specifically about pretrial SAMs. However, she did note one thing, that Jeffrey Epstein was the first person to kill themselves at MCC since 2013. Now, to be honest, I cannot know how, you know, for sure how Jeffrey Epstein died, whether he simply decided to end his life because of all the pressure from the trial and the public exposure and the lengthy sentence awaiting him, or whether he was killed because he was too dangerous and the elites wanted to tie up some loose ends. But let me tell you something that we can verify. This wasn't the first time Jeffrey Epstein was in jail, as we were saying earlier. He was arrested in 2007. But how come he got off so easily? Well, it turns out that Alexander Acosta was the Miami Attorney General at the time. And while he was being interviewed a couple of years later for the position of Labor Secretary by Donald Trump's transition team, Acosta revealed that, quote, I was told Epstein belonged to intelligence and to leave it alone. And now you see why he cut Jeffrey Epstein a non-prosecution plea deal. If all of this wasn't enough, you know, all of this horrible sex trafficking, it also seems that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell and Jean-Luc Brunel had ties to at least Israeli intelligence, if not also American intelligence. You know, Epstein had been known to brag about working for the Mossad. And Acosta just gives him a slap on the wrist because he knows that he's working with intelligence. Now, Epstein's longtime partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, her father, Robert Maxwell, is known to have been both a KGB and Mossad agent. You see, Robert Maxwell was a very famous media tycoon who owned 6 national newspapers in the UK. He also famously stole around £500 million from his own workers' pension funds. Now, journalist Whitney Webb, who's done fantastic work on Epstein, she's written extensively about Robert Maxwell's exploits as a Mossad agent in great detail. At one point, for example, Robert Maxwell acquired a company called Information on Demand, which was a front. It was a cutout for the Mossad. And they sold an Israeli piece of software called Promise, right? And this software was sold to governments around the world. And it had a back door inside it, allowing the Israelis to penetrate and spy on the very clients they had sold it to. So Robert Maxwell even sold Promise, this software, to a Los Angeles-based firm called Sandia National Laboratories, which provided Israeli intelligence with direct access to the core of the U.S. nuclear weapons program and nuclear weapons technology. And speaking of nuclear technology, it's also believed that Robert Maxwell is the one who tipped off the Israeli embassy in London about the Israeli nuclear scientist Mordechai Vanunu, after Vanunu had divulged the existence of Israel's nuclear program to the press. Right, Vanunu was subsequently kidnapped in Rome. They flew him to Israel and then sentenced him to almost 2 decades in prison. And when the issue of Robert Maxwell being a Mossad spy was brought up, because you have to keep in mind, he was also a member of parliament in the UK, so this was quite the scandal. And when this was brought up, no one would print it because the press feared being hit with a libel suit, right? So instead, what happened is George Galloway and Rupert Allison, who were both MPs at the time, they went and raised this issue in the House of Commons, exposing Robert Maxwell as a Mossad spy. And by extension, this allowed the British press to start printing about it without fear of reprisal or fear of being sued by Maxwell and his lawyers. Now, just a few weeks later, mysteriously, Maxwell died after allegedly falling off of his yacht. He was buried. He was buried with full honors at the Mount of Olives. And you know who attended his funeral? The Israeli Prime Minister and President, and at least 6 former and serving heads of the Mossad. Maybe that will give you an idea about how important he was for the Israelis, that all of these figures are attending his funeral. And so that's Ghislaine Maxwell's father, right? But if you thought the only connection here to the Mossad was her father, well, you'd better think again. Journalist Jeff Shalev conducted an interview in 2019 with an individual named Ari Ben Menashe. Ben Menashe was a, quote, Israeli consultant and former arms dealer who also served as a senior executive for Israel's Directorate of Military Intelligence from 1977 to 1987. So this puts Ben Menashe in a unique position to divulge about Epstein and also Maxwell, because he met them both 40 years ago when he was working for Israel alongside Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell. And so in this interview, Ben Menashe is asked, quote, you spoke about Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell as being part of Israeli military intelligence. Do you know specifically which unit? Ben Menashe replies that, quote, because of Robert Maxwell, they worked directly with military intelligence. I don't know who they answer to. The interviewer then continues, would you say that she was an agent as well and in military intelligence as well? Ben Menashe says yes, yes to both. And so Ben Menashe also makes another thing very clear, that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, the entire point of their sex trafficking operation was to, quote, blackmail American and other political figures by specifically seeking out underage girls for their friends. And as for Jean-Luc Brunel, he used his modeling agency to traffic girls to Epstein, right? And unsurprisingly, he had an office in where? Tel Aviv, right? An office in Tel Aviv as part of his modeling agency with Epstein. And so here in this picture, you can see Brunel wearing a cap that reads Israel Army. Again, that's perhaps not the most incriminating thing, but do keep it in mind. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Graham Elwood. He's an American comedian, podcaster, and writer. He hosts a progressive YouTube show and podcast called The Political Vigilante. He's also the co-host of Government Secrets with Lee Camp. Graham has been covering the Jeffrey Epstein saga for several years now, which even resulted in his YouTube channel being demonetized. Graham, could you maybe just to start off, give us a very brief overview of the Epstein case in the simplest terms so anyone can get it?
I have a whole Epstein playlist on my YouTube channel. And one of the most critical interviews I would ask people to watch is where I interview a former child crimes investigator, my friend Eric Oldenburg, who was on the Phoenix Police Department for 24 years. And he investigated online, basically, child trafficking and child pornography and and pretty gnarly stuff. And I mean, he said, you know, anyone can be a pedophile, any socioeconomic status, any ethnicity, any gender, any sexual orientation. Sexual orientation doesn't even necessarily correlate. He said, but the people that can get away with it the most are the wealthy and most powerful. And that's what the Epstein case is. If you want to understand how the ruling elites operate, start paying attention to the Epstein case, because you've got, in the intelligence community, specifically CIA and Mossad, are their handprints are all over this. And, you know, like with these examples, just some basic stuff. So when Epstein was arrested in West Palm Beach, Florida in 2008, 2009 in that area, Acosta was the prosecutor, and he was told to... Epstein was a CIA asset and to back off. And that's why he gave him a very lenient case, a charge. Basically, he got to leave his prison every day and fly around and literally traffic and abuse girls.
And when you mention powerful people and the ruling elites, you know, you have a lot of pictures, photographs of celebrities and very rich and important personalities that have photographed with Epstein or Maxwell. And we've also heard of this black book full of names. Could you basically tell us what that is and why we see so many important people photographed with Epstein and people related, people in his entourage?
One of the things, and this has been confirmed in other places, one of the things Epstein would do, he'd have these parties with the wealthiest, most powerful people in the world. Billionaires, politicians, I mean, presidents, several different royal families, including the Saudis and the British royal family. And so this powerful person would come in. One of Epstein's butlers would say, "Hey, would you like a massage from a beautiful young woman?" The guy would say yes. And it would be, they'd have sex and it would be a child. And they'd videotape it. Then Epstein would say, "Well, now I've got evidence of you having sex with a child." And they would then invest in Epstein's, he had some like fake hedge fund. So this is one of the ways Epstein got power. And this is why the intelligence community went, "Oh, this is an asset, because now we can use these videotapes as leverage." So what is so significant here, Richard, is when Epstein was arrested in July of 2019, we saw the video and the footage of the guys in the FBI coats dragging out, you know, not dragging, but like wheeling out on dolly trucks, boxes of photos, videos, hard drives, all this stuff. None of it. We have seen any of it. So what we have seen is just these little snippets. We've seen like the photos you've seen online. We've seen the flight logs. And I think the flight logs are very critical as well. They show stuff like Bill Clinton on his plane 26 times, Hillary on his plane two times. Trump was originally thought to only be on one time, but more flight logs were released at the end of December during the Maxwell trial, showing Trump was actually on five times. So to your question here, where is that information? Well, that is the reason why this stuff is getting swept under the rug, because the richest, most powerful people are on video. So That's why Jean-Luc Brunel is dead, is because he probably wouldn't play ball or had information or threatened to make a deal with the prosecutor saying, I'll give you these videotapes, give me a lighter sentence. And then all of a sudden, oh, wow, he's so distraught, he's going to hang himself. It's believed that Maxwell has so much information, and she's ruthless. She plays hardball, that she has, you know, I don't know, some people will call it like whatever you are, like a kill switch, basically. My belief is, Jelaine Maxwell said, if I go down, you
sorry
go
to cut
down.
You off. I was going to ask you about the Maxwell trial, about Ghislaine Maxwell. I mean, how does she tie into Epstein? What's the relationship, and why is she so important to this case? And what did you make of the trial that took place a few months ago?
We'll call her socialite, Epstein's gal pal, maybe even a recruiter. But according to several Epstein victims, including Virginia Roberts Giuffre, Anne Maria Farmer, and Maria Farmer's sister, Annie Farmer, she participated. So she's a pedophile. Like, let's be real clear here. And the media will not call Jelaine Maxwell a pedophile. She is a pedophile and a sex trafficker. And all the women that survived said Maxwell treated them horribly. She treated them like trash.
Well, I mean, speaking of these political connections, one thing that I was really interested in asking you is that, you know, the connections to the Mossad, because you mentioned it briefly at the beginning. If I recall correctly, Brunel, he had one of these modeling agency offices in Tel Aviv, right? And we've heard many times that Maxwell is connected to the Mossad. Could you explain what that connection is and how this relates to the intelligence, specifically U.S. and Israeli?
Maxwell's father was a Mossad agent, and he had a mysterious death, jumped off a boat or some very sort of odd, mysterious death. So you have that. Then you have, as I stated earlier, Acosta said in an interview in 2009 that he was told to go easy on the prosecution of Epstein in Florida because he was this is Acosta's words, not mine, a quote CIA asset. Right. And then you have, again, John Kiriakou said this in my interview with him, and I asked him about the CIA. I said, does the CIA condone getting children for pedophiles? He goes, no, but if you went, I'm going to get a child for this pedophile because if I get him children, then we can leverage that and use him as an asset. The CIA would go, okay, because they just want the leverage and the intel. And then seeing how, again, going back to Epstein's like fake hedge fund, these guys would donate money to it. And I'm blanking on the names. There was another big hedge fund guy. I can't keep track of all their names, but he donated or invested a lot of money with Epstein. And then women have spoken out against him. So what intelligence is doing, they needed people like Epstein to help them get leverage on all of these people. And they were like, look, Epstein, we'll let him have, you know, do whatever he wants on his plane and on his island as long as he keeps feeding us intel. Until he kept getting, I think Epstein was one of these guys that was so egregious with it that then he became a problem and they got rid of him. From the intelligence standpoint, if they've got video of somebody or some evidence, then that person's easy to control. If that person is found guilty and goes to prison, they don't have them. They don't have, that person has no more power. They have no more leverage. So they need these key people to get all this stuff done. And they've got, you know, leverage on, you know, the Saudi royal family. They've got, and you know, as I said, John Kiriakou said, this feels like the Israelis. He felt like Mossad, his first gut instinct as a former CIA operative was that Mossad was involved in Epstein's death. This all feels very coordinated and maneuvered by those two intelligence agencies.
There is one really important aspect, though, that the victims themselves have underscored, which is that Jeffrey Epstein used these girls to blackmail powerful people. And so, yes, Epstein and Ghislaine are very obviously depraved individuals who preyed on others. But they also did this to get dirt on the wealthy, on politicians, on businessmen, and anyone that mattered. And they did this in service of Israeli intelligence. They did this at the behest of the Mossad. And again, that's not only speculation. This is now confirmed. It's on the record, confirmed by former Israeli intelligence officials, as we were just going through. And so in addition to all of the already vile, deplorable sexual assaults that this entire saga is mired with, we can see now that there is very clearly a political dimension to it as well. And the fact that the media won't talk about this and never tackle this angle, it really speaks volumes, right? Why do they refuse to talk about this? And how come, despite unsealing so many documents, the courts still continue to keep many of them under wraps? What are they hiding from us exactly? And what could be the other dark secrets in the spy world that we're yet to discover? Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the All Beneficent, the All Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atar, the host of this program. Within the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Ali Himani and Shaykh Qasim. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome. So today we want to talk about a very controversial topic, and that is owning a gun. Is it at all right to have a gun, or should all people have the right to own guns? Of course, in some countries, amendments in their constitution, they are allowed to carry a gun, whether it would be an open carry or a concealed carry, but they are allowed, you know, somehow to have gun. But is it at all, according to the Islamic rulings, to have a gun or something like a gun with yourself? Who to start with? Sheikh Qasim, let's start with you.
Yeah, sure. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وأهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين. You know, with respect to the Islamic view on having guns and owning guns, you know, when we refer to the history of Islam, actually, for sure, it was no gun at that time, but yes. But there were actually weapons at the time, and everybody, almost everybody has had guns, weapons,
at that time. They used to carry a sword along with them.
But with respect to guns, you know, it's a different sort of weapon, you know, a really deadly, actually, weapon. So you can shoot it without even being detected. You know, we can use, you know, such weapons. Let's start. I believe that we may be better start from the, you know, the countries that now are, you know, have guns, you know, and it's legal to own gun in those countries. And I believe that in those countries, it may be based on at least two reasons. The first is the laws that actually the liberal laws that they have that gives every right to everybody, as far as it doesn't actually violate other people's, you know, rights. Actually, this is what is written in those laws. Okay. Whether it's applied or not, that's something else. That's another issue.
Okay.
This is the first actually reason that they actually refer to and actually quote when you ask them why you allow people having guns. And the second one is that, you know, if you have, for example, access to guns, and it's a sort of it's a way to defend yourself, you know, and you know, a sort of empower you. Besides having, you know, the police and, you know, the
it's a kind of shield against, you know.
So you yourself can actually carry out what the police that, you know, can actually help you with. So you yourself can help yourself. So this is what they call. It's true or not, or is it? Does it justify having guns or not? That's something else that we have to talk about.
You know, based on what you said about these tribal behaviors, you know, it is not related to the religion of Islam, because so many years before the religion of Islam in the Arab Peninsula, the tribes and the head of the tribes and all those, you know, people used to carry their swords with themselves. even the swords and the knives or the cold arms were parts of the lives of the people. Nowadays, this we can say this shooting and these hot arms, you know, that are in the hands of the people is more dangerous than the past. But the case is that we claim to be civilized societies, Sheikh. And through this, so-called civilization, especially coming from the Western world, the good, beautiful picture that we have, still people are free to have guns, you know. And when you look at just the news, you know, the gun laws and the policies or the school shootings that are taking place all around the world. Is it really at all useful for the people to carry guns?
I think we need to take a step back and, you know, refer to the very point that you mentioned about the tribes carrying weapons with them. You know, every individual used to have either a dagger or a knife or a sword with him, right?
Okay.
But in history, you would rarely find that just out of emotional, explosion or an emotional outburst, someone would just pull out a sword and kill someone. Until and unless it's a really deep-rooted conflict. Or you say it's a tribal war that has been going on for hundreds of years, and then they meet each other and then they pull out their swords and start fighting. So what you would see in history is, you know, you can look at it across the world. You can look at the English region, you can look at the Asian region where you had Indians and the Mughals and the other kings. People used to carry swords with them, but they had an emotional balance, meaning that they would never allow emotional outbursts or emotional feeling to overtake their personality and lose their temper or lose their control. But that is not so in today's world.
Yes.
So even if you say that this weapon is dangerous by itself, but another problem here is people lacking the ability to control themselves emotionally. Mm-hmm. And this is where this weapon becomes even more dangerous.
Yes.
Because people do not... They don't want to, or they feel that it's pointless to control yourself. They say, if you're upset, just express it. If you're angry, just express it. So this is where you will see that some absolutely silly reasons that have been in the news that, you know, a guy driving a car, he's driving slowly, someone honks from behind, he gets off the car, goes and shoots the guy.
Yes.
Right? Why? Because he's not able to control his emotional element. So even though... if the weapon is legal, there's another aspect that plays a vital role in making this weapon dangerous. So if you look at there are many countries where weapons are legalized, but you will see that they have laws and they have a culture, and that culture plays a very, very important role.
That's right.
But if you look at the culture in the Western world, particularly America, there the culture is, you know, let it go. Let go of your feelings. Let go or express yourself, you know, express what's deep inside you. And telling them to let out their heat is where this weapon usage has become dangerous today.
That's right. 4 in 10 U.S. adults say they live in a household with a gun, including 30% who say they personally own one. And personal protection tops the list, you know, of the reasons why gun owners, they say, own a firearm. Let's talk about this personal protection. You know, they say personal protection in order to have personal... Why living at all in a world or in a society that the governments, the states, cannot safeguard your protection? Then you have to carry a gun with yourself to safeguard yourself.
Actually, I was getting ready for this show, and I was watching a documentary. It was actually a rather interesting documentary, going here and there, you know, to the countries that weapons are legal and, you know, owning gun is okay. Mm-hmm. And this guy actually went to Switzerland, and Switzerland is one of the countries.
Was it by Michael Moore?
I'm not sure.
The documentary?
No, it was not. So this person actually was asking this Swiss person, and asking him, okay, so do you carry your gun for your self-defense? And he said, absolutely not. And this is not the reason that you have to own, you know, a gun. And if you have, ask anybody in Switzerland, that, you know, whether you carry a gun or you have a gun. Actually, they don't carry guns, you know, here and there, you know. So it's a sort of hobby and, you know, a fun activity to do in some certain places.
Okay.
And there are very restricted laws in that country with respect to guns. But when you go to America, now this person said that almost 60-61% of the people who are asked whether they are, you know, why they're actually own a gun, they say for self-defense. Mm-hmm. So it was very actually interesting, you know, contrast between these two countries. Mm-hmm. And in the first one, actually, in Switzerland, the murder and actually the mass shooting is almost zero there.
Okay.
So this mentality of self-defense, I think it doesn't solve the problem, you know. So this person was, you know, uprightly was actually asked whether you are.
But in critical cases and critical situations, the people might use this hobby, you know, toy.
No, actually, we need to ask a question that what would be that critical case or what would be that critical scenario? You would say, okay, I have a thief entering my house, you know, someone trying to rob my house.
Okay.
You would say that if the government right at the beginning does not allow people to own the gun, then this person entering my house forcefully or a thief would not have a gun.
Okay.
If he doesn't have a gun, I don't need to have a gun for self-protection.
Mm-hmm.
I can use a baseball bat. I can use a knife.
Okay.
If he has a knife, I can use a knife, right?
Okay.
The fact that the government is allowing people to own the gun is leading other people to seek a gun for self-protection.
That's
right. So right at the beginning, if the government says no need for guns, for example, take Singapore. It's a small country.
Yes, yes.
Guns is prohibited.
Yes.
There are no gun crimes there. There's no shooting. No one's in last 10 years, if you go and search there, no murder by gun, right?
Yes.
No crimes by gun. So if the government right at the beginning stops possession of the guns by all individuals, then you wouldn't need a gun for self-protection at all.
And it's really a money-making industry in the world. You know, because these guns, at least the big ones, as long as they are put in the arsenals or in the weapons houses, it's okay with the countries. For example, in a war taking place, they use it. But for a society, you know, in order to sell it to the people, it would be, I think, a profitable industry.
Again, see, if you look at particularly America, it's a chaos there.
Yes,
you know,
it's
everyone
chaos,
who's owning a gun, anybody can pull out a gun at any time. And point goes back to this, that where did it all begin?
Mm-hmm.
It began from the time of slavery.
Yes.
When they had many black slaves at home.
Yes.
And you were scared that these 20 people would turn up against our family of five people and kill us or massacre us.
Yes.
And that's why, to protect themselves,
they
used to have guns, right?
Or the Native Indians of America.
All right. So Native Indians did not have guns.
No.
They had only, you know, spears and swords and daggers. So it wasn't a big deal to fight against them. But when you had slaves living in your house, you have 10 slaves, you have 5 slaves, you have 8 slaves living in your house, and your family is 5 people.
Yes.
And they were worried that in the middle of the night, if they attack us and kill us, how do I defend myself against 10 people? So I need to have a gun. And that is where it all started off.
I believe there is also a legacy of having a gun, you know, in the American history, because it's a new civilization of these cowboy things, carrying a gun. And all this type of lifestyle, generation after generation, you know, gave the people a kind of sociopolitical and cultural ethics to go on. And it still is active. So an American is made known by his typical lifestyle, having a gun, having a type of hat, you know, on the horse and something like that, acting like a cowboy. But gun is an inseparable part of the people. Today's people in the streets of the U.S. are not cowboys, but they still have the legacy of carrying a gun.
Let me add two more elements that are adding up to this actually culture, American culture. This is what I understand. The first one is the media, you know.
Yes.
So you have this violence in the movies that are made there, and you know. So that is how they are actually provoking up people to have guns and to, you know, to sort of have the role model of that person who is shooting, you know, these people.
Yes.
So this is one thing. And the other thing is, you know, the way that the American politicians actually are acting. They're acting as if they are the boss of everybody in the world, you know. So they are bullying other countries, the politicians, So, and we have this, that, you know, this fact that the people, you know, actually are following and they take their politicians as their role models. So I believe that one of the reasons that the American people may feel to, you know, to a sort of act violently is the way that the leaders, you know, are acting in the world.
Taking them as ideals.
Yeah.
Brother Atta has rightly pointed out that it's an industry there, right?
Yes.
And if they want to make profit out of it, they want to make money out of it, they need to promote the idea that you need to have a gun. Because if they don't promote that idea,
they have to protect yourself.
Exactly.
So we sell you guns, that's right.
Exactly. Okay. Else, if they don't do that, their industry would die, right? Yeah. So what do they do? How do they promote is where Sheikh Qasim has pointed out that the media, the using media, Hollywood industry, movies, where they're showing Assassin's Creed and Hitman and other movies, where they're showing people with the guns are the ones who have the upper hand. Mm-hmm. They are the man, right? They're showing machoism there. So everyone wants to feel man, right? Yes. So he's walking with his friends and there are 50 of them. Among these 50, I'm the boss. I'm the guy. I'm the man. To feel that, he needs to carry a gun with him that he can show his authority among others. And this, again, rightly pointed out, this is being copied, not just from media, from the politicians, because it's the politicians who are showing the world that we have a certain missile, we have a certain set of warheads, we have these many weapons, we have these many tankers, we have these many nuclear warheads, and therefore we are the man, we are the best army, best resistance force or best military service on the planet. And this gives them the sense of power. So now the culture has become that if you want to show your power, you want to show your authority, you want to show that you're the boss, you're the guy around here, and everyone should listen to you, then you need to have a gun with you.
You can find it also in the games that the children are playing, you know, such graphic scenes and the violence that is over there, the shooting. And you know that the school shooting in the U.S., you know, mean an attack on this institutional education or something like that, such as primary school or university, is a big case now in the U.S. And year after year, administration after administration, they are adding amendments to the U.S. Constitution in order to control it, but they are not still successful. Thank you very much, Sheikh Qasim and Sheikh Ali Himani, for your presence in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Man has been created to achieve perfection, to work hard to live a better life, to endeavor to achieve a better life. Perfection is the ultimate purpose for which God has created humanity and human beings, and on the way to perfection, human beings are equipped with desire. All have some degree of self-love. Every individual has some degree of self-love. So they desire and make efforts for their well-being, for a better future, for a better life, and yet they often make mistakes in deciding what is really better for them, because sometimes human beings are overwhelmed by their instincts, by their physical desires. It makes it very difficult for the human being to understand what is in his best interest. But human beings have the power to follow the path to perfection. Human beings are not like any other creatures. Human beings can understand facts and decide what to do and what is in his best interest. He's not like other creatures to move on with the help of their instincts. Human beings can resist sin, and human beings can choose not to commit sins. There are different people and with different stages, with different degrees of piety, with different degrees of self-restraint. Some human beings are respected and honorable. They are not attracted to temporary material interests. Some are healthy in their bodies, so they engage in more voluntary fasting to obtain greater spiritual rewards.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Different people are there with different, you know, characteristics. And these differences are natural. They are the necessary demands of this material universe. But we should know that according to Islam, rewards and punishments are and will be decided in consideration of man's power and abilities. Man is not held responsible for what he cannot do. Man is not held responsible beyond his capacity. لا يكلف الله نفسا إلا وسعها. And God does not obligate an individual beyond his capacity. Everyone is held responsible and everyone is reckoned and brought to justice based on the capacity and the ability he has. If someone has really no power to understand or to act according to Islamic rules, according to Islamic laws, and if someone has no understanding of the Islamic, you know, doctrines, Islamic teachings, he's excused. And Allah is, of course, most generous. Allah is most merciful. Allah is compassionate. Such people are there. Such people who are incompetent. Such people who do not understand and perceive their obligations and who have no idea whatsoever what their obligation is. They are not guilty in the eye of Allah, and therefore God does not punish such people. But most people are wise enough and they are sufficiently able to understand and follow the right path toward their perfection. They are equipped with the ability and with the power to achieve perfection. They are equipped with the faculty of wisdom, the faculty of intellect. And so, depending on one's ability, a person is held responsible for whatever he does. So, Almighty Allah takes these differences into His consideration when He wants to reward people, when He wants to punish people. He expects more of those people who are given more talents and more ability, capacity as compared to other people. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
The divine judgment the resurrection is based on one's capacity. And let's understand that the most pious deed is the most difficult one. أفضل الأعمال أحمزها. And if a person needs more time to learn how to pray or to memorize verses of the Holy Quran, for example, his rewards will be greater and Allah will help him more. And we should understand that, of course, if we suffer in the way of Allah, if we suffer in the way of achieving perfection, and if we suffer in the way of getting closer to Allah, Allah will double the rewards that we achieve. Allah will give us and bestow upon us the rewards that we deserve. So every individual receives the reward based on what he has done and what he has achieved, and based on the proximity and the closeness that he has attained with Allah. Generally speaking, human beings have no difficulty when it comes to power and desire or inclination which are needed in every decision and action, you know, because man is equipped. Man has the capacity and the necessary power to choose what he has to choose and what he has to do. He has the ability and the power. He has been given the power to achieve knowledge. He has been given the power to achieve perfection. It is he who should actually make his mind up to achieve knowledge, not only of himself and of his soul, but also of his Lord. And most of the problems actually arise from a lack of knowledge. Most of the problems arise from ignorance. Most of the problems arise from a lack of the individual's will to perfect himself. Dear brothers and sisters, there are something which we need to know, and there are some questions that we have to, you know, sometimes encounter in our life and which we have to find answers. First of all, we should know ourselves. How are we created? Why are we created? What are our needs? What are our real desires and our motives? What are our faculties and abilities? Are there any tasks or duties for us? Now, these are some very important questions to encounter, to understand, and then try to find answers to these questions. What is our present situation, and under what conditions do we live? How is our life in this universe? Is it the only life that we have? Is there any eternal life for us? What good or bad qualities do we have? These are questions that we need to answer. These are the basic and the most important questions that we need to answer and that we need to ask ourselves. What is the best position for us? And what values and goods can we acquire? What is a perfect man like? These are also some questions that we need to encounter and to find answers for. Of course, there are more and more questions that we sometimes come across, and sometimes we have to ask ourselves and find answers in order for us to be able to achieve perfection and to achieve a better life. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash. Share, he knows. Allah knows.
Aperture.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met Heather, Josh, and Rachel. All three suffer from disability and chronic illnesses. All three are children to fathers who fought in Vietnam, and all three are victims of Agent Orange. And now they decide to embark on a journey to return to the country where their tragic story began as children of war veterans and as victims of war. Now stay with us to witness the rest of this emotional and healing journey.
My father lost his arm before he chose to have children. He lost his arm during the war. And then it took him 7 years to cope with that and feel that maybe he was mentally able to help raise a child.
The things that he had seen, he would always have flashbacks, and he suffered from PTSD really bad from all the things that he did and saw while he was in the war. And he was very abusive, and he was very violent, and he would black out at times and think that he was still in the war. And there was times like we would get up in the middle of the night, me and my brother, and we would try to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and he would be like hiding under our beds and grab our feet and pull us under the beds. And I mean, he had PTSD really bad.
He suffered flashbacks, lots of flashbacks. Many nights he'd wake up moaning and groaning, screaming and yelling in his sleep.
They would put him in the helicopters and stuff, and they would fly him all over and drop him off in the jungle, and they would get out of the helicopters, and the helicopters would leave him out there, and there would only be like maybe 30 guys. They were hiding everywhere, and you couldn't really run through the jungle because everything was booby-trapped, and there was pits with the spikes in them and landmines everywhere and tripwires, and they had these big logs that had a bunch of bamboo spikes on them, and they'd put them up in the trees. When you'd walk by and you'd trip a stick or whatever, it would fall down out of the tree and impale people. And he said there was times that while they were on the battlefield that he would have to go, and like his friend would be walking right in front of him, and he would step on a landmine and pieces of his friend would fly all over him, and he would have to pick up the pieces and put them in his backpack and carry them out.
He spent a lot of time by himself, very quiet. We were raised with war decor in our home, lots of Vietnam memorabilia, pictures and videos, books, that sort of thing. So it was always around us, and we always knew what had happened to our father. We never knew him any other way, so we always knew what had happened to him.
He just couldn't take it anymore. He tried to drink the pain away. He tried to work it away. He tried to tell me and my brother everything that he went through. He tried talking about it. He tried everything. And when he first got there and everything, he was just out of high school, and what he encountered when he got over there was not what he expected at all. One of the missions that he had got sent on when he first got here was that they went into a village, and the whole time I've been here, I've been trying to ask people and everything, and the other day, we were at another VAVA office, and we were there with the general, and when he started to open the book, it was mentioned that my father was in Chu Lai. Everybody that was in there said, "Oh, Chu Lai." And it kind of made me start to think, well, what went on in Chu Lai that was so bad that everybody knows about it? And he was explaining all that. But then when he found Chu Lai on the map, he pointed at it and he cried and shut the book and pushed it away from him. And that really hit home, because that's where my dad was at. And then when we got to the museum and I found where his company and everything was at, and I saw it on the wall, and I saw where they slaughtered all the women and children. And my dad was only 19 years old when he joined the military, when he came to Vietnam. So at 19 years old, that's what they told him to do. And they made him kill women and children. And there was like 500 of them. It wasn't like just one or two or three. It was 500 women and children. And like 70-something of those women were pregnant. So they killed the babies too. And that was the first week that my dad was here. And then he